to master it. Often I make the same mistake at the same place in a particular movement. I go to bed frustrated. But when I wake up the next morning and sit back down at the piano, I can just play perfectly. I can just play. The words reverberated in my mind as I tried to compose a response. I told the gentleman that it was a fascinating idea, and it was certainly possible that sleep assisted musicianship and led to error-free performance, but that I knew of no scientific evidence to support the claim. He smiled, seeming unfazed by the absence of empirical affirmation, thanked me again for my lecture, and walked toward the reception hall. I, on the other hand, remained in the auditorium, realizing that this gentleman had just told me something that violated the most repeated and entrusted teaching edict. Practice makes perfect. Not so, it seemed. Perhaps it was practice with sleep that makes perfect. After 3 years of subsequent research, I published a paper with a similar title, and in the studies that followed, gathered evidence that ultimately confirmed all of the pianist's wonderful intuitions about sleep. The findings also shed light on how the brain, after injury or damage by a stroke, gradually regains some ability to guide skill movements day by day, or, should I say, night by night. By that time, I had taken a position at Harvard Medical School, and with Robert Stickgold, a mentor and now a longtime collaborator and friend, we set about trying to determine if and how the brain continues to learn in the absence of any further practice. Time was clearly doing something. But it seemed that there were, in fact, three distinct possibilities to discriminate among. Was it 1. Time, 2. Time awake, or 3. Time asleep that incubated skilled memory perfection? I took a large group of right-handed individuals and had them learn to type a number sequence on a keyboard with their left hand, such as 41324, as quickly and as accurately as possible. Like learning a piano scale, subjects practiced the motor skill sequence over and over again for a total of 12 minutes, taking short breaks throughout. Unsurprisingly, the participants improved in their performance across the training session. Practice, after all, is supposed to make perfect. We then tested the participants 12 hours later. Half of the participants had learned the sequence in the morning and were tested later that evening after remaining awake across the day. The other half of the subjects learned the sequence in the evening, and we retested them the next morning after a similar 12-hour delay, but one that contained a full 8-hour night of sleep. Those who remained awake across the day showed no evidence of a significant improvement in performance. However, fitting with the pianist's original description, those who were tested after the very same time delay of 12 hours, but that spanned a night of sleep, showed a striking 20% jump in performance speed and a near 35% improvement in accuracy. Importantly, those participants who learned the motor skill in the morning and who showed no improvement that evening did go on to show an identical bump up in performance when retested after a further 12 hours, now after they too had had a full night's sleep. In other words, your brain will continue to improve skill memories in the absence of any further practice. It is really quite magical. Yet that delayed, offline learning occurs exclusively across a period of sleep, and not across equivalent time periods spent awake, regardless of whether the time awake or time asleep comes first. Practice does not make perfect. It is practice, followed by a night of sleep, that leads to perfection. We went on to show that these memory-boosting benefits occur no matter whether you learn a short or a very long motor sequence. For example, 4312 versus 423-423-143-414. Or when using one hand, unimanual, or both, bimanual, similar to a pianist. Analyzing the individual elements of the motor sequence, such as 41324, allowed me to discover how, precisely, sleep was perfecting skill. Even after a long period of initial training, Participants would consequently struggle with particular transitions within the sequence. These problem points stuck out like a sore thumb when I looked at the speed of the keystrokes. There would be a far longer pause or consistent error at specific transitions. For example, rather than seamlessly typing 41324, 41324, a participant would instead type 413, pause, 24, 413, pause, 24. They were chunking the motor routine into pieces, as if attempting the sequence all in one go was just too much. Different people had different pause problems at different points in the routine, but almost all people had one or two of these difficulties. I assessed so many participants that I could actually tell where the unique difficulties in the motor routine were just by listening to their typing during training. When I tested participants after a night of sleep, however, my ears heard something very different. I knew what was happening even before I analyzed the data. Mastery. Their typing, post-sleep, was now fluid and unbroken. Gone was the staccato performance, replaced by seamless automaticity, which is the ultimate goal of motor learning. 41324, 41324, 41324, rapid and nearly perfect. Sleep had systematically identified where the difficult transitions were in the motor memory and smoothed them out. This finding rekindled the words of the pianist I'd met. But when I wake up the next morning and sit back down at the piano, I can just play perfectly. I went on to test participants inside a brain scanner after they had slept, and could see how this delightful skill benefit had been achieved. Sleep had again transferred the memories, but the results were different from that for textbook-like memory. Rather than a transfer from short to long-term memory required for saving facts, the motor memories had been shifted over to brain circuits that operate below the level of consciousness. As a result, those skill actions were now instinctual habits. They flowed out of the body with ease, rather than feeling effortful and deliberate. Which is to say that sleep helped the brain automate the movement routines, making them second nature, effortless, precisely the goal of many an Olympic coach when perfecting the skills of their elite athletes. My final discovery, in what spanned almost a decade of research, identified the type of sleep responsible for the overnight motor skill enhancement, carrying with it societal and medical lessons. The increases in speed and accuracy, underpinned by efficient automaticity, were directly related to the amount of stage 2 NREM, especially in the last 2 hours of an 8-hour night of sleep. For example, from 5 to 7 a.m., should you have fallen asleep at 11 p.m. Indeed, it was the number of those wonderful sleep spindles in the last 2 hours of the late morning, the time of night with the richest spindle bursts of brainwave activity, that were linked with the offline memory boost. More striking was the fact that the increase of these spindles after learning was detected only in regions of the scalp that sit above the motor cortex, just in front of the crown of your head, and not in other areas. The greater the local increase in sleep spindles over the part of the brain we had forced to learn the motor skill exhaustively, the better the performance upon awakening. Many other groups have found a similar local sleep and learning effect. When it comes to motor skill memories, the brainwaves of sleep were acting like a good masseuse. You still get a full body massage, but they will place special focus on areas of the body that need the most help. In the same way, sleep spindles bathe all parts of the brain, but a disproportionate emphasis will be placed on those parts of the brain that have been worked hardest with learning during the day. Perhaps more relevant to the modern world is the time of night effect we discovered. Those last 2 hours of sleep are precisely the window that many of us feel it is okay to cut short to get a jump start on the day. As a result, we miss out on this feast of late morning sleep spindles. It also brings to mind the prototypical Olympic coach who stoically has her athletes practicing late into the day, only to have them wake in the early hours of the morning and return to practice. In doing so, coaches may be innocently but effectively denying an important phase of motor memory development within the brain, one that fine-tunes skilled athletic performance. When you consider that very small performance differences often separate winning a gold medal from a last-place finish in professional athletics, then any competitive advantage you can gain, such as that naturally offered by sleep, can help determine whether or not you will hear your national anthem echo around the stadium. Not without putting too fine a point on it, if you don't snooze, you lose. The 100-meter sprint superstar Usain Bolt has, on many occasions, taken naps in the hours before breaking the world record and before Olympic finals in which he won gold. Our own studies support his wisdom. Daytime naps that contain sufficient numbers of sleep spindles also offer significant motor skill memory improvement, together with a restoring benefit on perceived energy and reduced muscle fatigue. In the years since our discovery, numerous studies have shown that sleep improves the motor skills of junior, amateur, and elite athletes across sports as diverse as tennis, basketball, football, soccer, and rowing. So much so that in 2015, the International Olympic Committee published a consensus statement highlighting the critical importance of and essential need for sleep in athletic development across all sports for men and women. Professional sports teams are taking note, and for good reason. I have recently given presentations to a number of national basketball and football teams in the United States, and for the latter, the United Kingdom. Standing in front of the manager, staff, and players, I tell them about one of the most sophisticated, potent, and powerful, not to mention legal, performance enhancers that has real game-winning potential. Sleep. I back up these claims with examples from the more than 750 scientific studies that have investigated the relationship between sleep and human performance, many of which have studied professional and elite athletes specifically. Obtain anything less than 8 hours of sleep a night, and especially less than 6 hours a night, and the following happens. Time to physical exhaustion drops by 10 to 30%, and aerobic output is significantly reduced. Similar impairments are observed in limb extension force and vertical jump height, together with decreases in peak and sustained muscle strength. Add to this marked impairments in cardiovascular, metabolic, and respiratory capabilities that hamper an underslept body, including faster rates of lactic acid buildup, reductions in blood oxygen saturation, and converse increases in blood carbon dioxide, due in part to a reduction in the amount of air that the lungs can expire. Even the ability of the body to cool itself during physical exertion through sweating, a critical part of peak performance, is impaired by sleep loss. And then there is injury risk. It is the greatest fear of all competitive athletes and their coaches. Concern also comes from the general managers of professional teams, who consider their players as prized financial investments. In the context of injury, there is no better risk-mitigating insurance policy for these investments than sleep. Described in a research study of competitive young athletes in 2014, you can see that a chronic lack of sleep across the season predicted a massively higher risk of injury. See Figure 10 in the accompanying PDF. Sports teams pay millions of dollars to hugely expensive players, lavishing all manner of medical and nutritional care on their human commodities to augment their talent. Yet the professional advantage is diluted several-fold by the one ingredient few teams fail to prioritize: their players' sleep. Even teams that are aware of sleep's importance before a game are surprised by my declaration of the equally, if not more, essential need for sleep in the days after a game. Post-performance sleep accelerates physical recovery from common inflammation, stimulates muscle repair, and helps restock cellular energy in the form of glucose and glycogen. Prior to giving these teams a structured set of sleep recommendations that they can put in practice to help capitalize on the full potential of their athletes, I provide proof of concept data from the National Basketball Association, NBA, using the measured sleep of Andre Iguodala, currently of my local team, the Golden State Warriors. Based on sleep tracking data, as you can see in Figure 11 in the accompanying PDF, is the difference in Iguodala's performance when he's been sleeping more than 8 hours a night, relative to less than 8 hours a night. Of course, most of us do not play for professional sports teams, but many of us are physically active throughout life and constantly acquiring new skills. Motor learning and general physicality remain part of our lives, from the banal, learning to type on a slightly new laptop or text on a different size smartphone, to the essential, such as experienced surgeons learning a new endoscopic procedure or pilots learning to fly different or new aircraft. And so, therefore, we continue to need and rely upon our NREM sleep for refining and maintaining those motor movements. Of interest to parents, the most dramatic time of skilled motor learning in any human's life occurs in the first years after birth, as we start to stand and walk. It is of little surprise that we see a spike in stage 2 NREM sleep, including sleep spindles, right around the infant's time of transition from crawling to walking. Returning full circle to that which I had learned years ago at the Queen's Medical Center regarding brain damage, we have now discovered that the slow, day-by-day return of motor function in stroke patients is due, in part, to the hard night-by-night work of sleep. Following a stroke, the brain begins to reconfigure those neural connections that remain and sprout new connections around the damaged zone. This plastic reorganization and the genesis of new connections underlie the return of some degree of motor function. We now have preliminary evidence that sleep is one critical ingredient assisting in this neural recovery effort. Ongoing sleep quality predicts the gradual return of motor function and further determines the relearning of numerous movement skills. Should more such findings emerge, then a more concerted effort to prioritize sleep as a therapeutic aid in patients who have suffered brain damage may be warranted, or even the implementation of sleep stimulation methods like those described earlier. There is much that sleep can do that we in medicine currently cannot. So long as the scientific evidence justifies it, we should make use of the powerful health tool that sleep represents in making our patients well. Sleep for creativity. A final benefit of sleep for memory is arguably the most remarkable of all: creativity. Sleep provides a nighttime theater in which your brain tests out and builds connections between vast stores of information. This task is accomplished using a bizarre algorithm that is biased towards seeking out the most distant, non-obvious associations, rather like a backward Google search. In ways your waking brain would never attempt, the sleeping brain fuses together disparate sets of knowledge that foster impressive problem-solving abilities. If you ponder the type of conscious experience such outlandish memory blending would produce, you may not be surprised to learn that it happens during the dreaming state, REM sleep. We will fully explore all of the advantages of REM sleep in the later chapter on dreaming. For now, I will simply tell you that such informational alchemy conjured by REM sleep dreaming has led to some of the greatest feats of transformative thinking in the history of the human race. Chapter 7. Too extreme for the Guinness Book of World Records: sleep deprivation and the brain. Struck by the weight of damning scientific evidence, the Guinness Book of World Records has stopped recognizing attempts to break the sleep deprivation world record. Recall that Guinness deems it acceptable for a man, Felix Baumgartner, to ascend 128,000 feet into the outer reaches of our atmosphere in a hot air balloon, wearing a spacesuit, open the door of his capsule, stand atop a ladder suspended above the planet, and then freefall back down to Earth at a top speed of 843 miles per hour, 1,358 kilometers per hour, passing through the sound barrier while creating a sonic boom with just his body. But the risks associated with sleep deprivation are considered to be far, far higher. Unacceptably high, in fact, based on the evidence. What is that compelling evidence? In the following two chapters, We will learn precisely why and how sleep loss inflicts such devastating effects on the brain, linking it to numerous neurological and psychiatric conditions, for example, Alzheimer's disease, anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, suicide, stroke, and chronic pain, and on every physiological system of the body, further contributing to countless disorders and disease, for example, cancer, diabetes, heart attacks, infertility, weight gain, obesity, and immune deficiency. No facet of the human body is spared the crippling, noxious harm of sleep loss. We are, as you will see, socially, organizationally, economically, physically, behaviorally, nutritionally, linguistically, cognitively, and emotionally dependent upon sleep. This chapter deals with the dire and sometimes deadly consequences of inadequate sleep on the brain. The chapter that follows will recount the diverse, though equally ruinous and similarly fatal, effects of short sleep on the body. Pay attention. There are many ways in which a lack of sufficient sleep will kill you. Some take time, others are far more immediate. One brain function that buckles under even the smallest dose of sleep deprivation is concentration. The deadly societal consequences of these concentration failures play out most obviously and fatally in the form of drowsy driving. Every hour, someone dies in a traffic accident in the US due to a fatigue-related error. There are two main culprits of drowsy driving accidents. The first is people completely falling asleep at the wheel. This happens infrequently, however, and usually requires an individual to be acutely sleep-deprived, having gone without shut-eye for 20-plus hours. The second, more common cause, is a momentary lapse in concentration, called a microsleep. These last for just a few seconds, during which time the eyelid will either partially or fully close. They are usually suffered by individuals who are chronically sleep-restricted, defined as getting less than 7 hours of sleep a night on a routine basis. During a microsleep, your brain becomes blind to the outside world for a brief moment, and not just the visual domain, but in all channels of perception. Most of the time, you have no awareness of the event. More problematic is that your decisive control of motor actions, such as those necessary for operating a steering wheel or a brake pedal, will momentarily cease. As a result, you don't need to fall asleep for 10 to 15 seconds to die while driving. 2 seconds will do it. A 2-second microsleep at 30 miles per hour with a modest angle of drift can result in your vehicle transitioning entirely from one lane to the next. This includes into oncoming traffic. Should this happen at 60 miles per hour, it may be the last microsleep you ever have. David Dinges at the University of Pennsylvania, a titan in the field of sleep research and personal hero of mine, has done more than any scientist in history to answer the following fundamental question. What is the recycle rate of a human being? That is, how long can a human go without sleep before their performance is objectively impaired? How much sleep can a human lose each night, and over how many nights, before critical processes of the brain fail? Is that individual even aware of how impaired they are when sleep-deprived? How many nights of recovery sleep does it take to restore the stable performance of a human after sleep loss? Dinges's research employs a disarmingly simple attention test to measure concentration. You must press a button in response to a light that appears on a button box or computer screen within a set period of time. Your response and the reaction time of that response are both measured. Thereafter, another light comes on, and you do the same thing. The lights appear in an unpredictable manner, sometimes in quick succession, other times randomly separated by a pause lasting several seconds. Sounds easy, right? Try doing it for 10 minutes straight, every day for 14 days. That's what Dinges and his research team did to a large number of subjects who were monitored under strict laboratory conditions. All of the subjects started off by getting a full 8-hour sleep opportunity the night before the test, allowing them to be assessed when fully rested. Then, the participants were divided into 4 different experimental groups. Rather like a drug study, each group was given a different dose of sleep deprivation. One group was kept up for 72 hours straight, going without sleep for 3 consecutive nights. The second group was allowed 4 hours of sleep each night. The third group was given 6 hours of sleep each night. The lucky fourth group was allowed to keep sleeping 8 hours each night. There were 3 key findings. First, although sleep deprivation of all these varied amounts caused a slowing in reaction time, there was something more telling. Participants would, for brief moments, stop responding altogether. Slowness was not the most sensitive signature of sleepiness. Entirely missed responses were. Dinges was capturing lapses, otherwise known as microsleeps, the real-life equivalent of which would be failing to react to a child who runs out in front of your car when chasing a ball. When describing the findings, Dinges will often have you think of the repeating beep from a heart monitor in a hospital. Beep, beep, beep. Now picture the dramatic sound effect you hear in emergency room television dramas when a patient starts to slip away as doctors frantically try to save their life. At first, the heartbeats are constant. Beep, 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 as are your responses on the visual attention task when you are well rested, stable, regular. Switch to your performance when sleep deprived, and it is the oral equivalent of the patient in the hospital going into cardiac arrest. Beep, 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 beep. Your performance has flatlined. No conscious response. No motor response. A microsleep. And then the heartbeat comes back, as will your performance. Beep, beep, beep. But only for a short while. Soon you have another arrest. Beep, beep, beep. More microsleeps. Comparing the number of lapses, or microsleeps, day after day across the 4 different experimental groups, gave Dinges a second key finding. Those individuals who slept 8 hours every night maintained a stable, near-perfect performance across the 2 weeks. Those in the 3-night total sleep deprivation group suffered catastrophic impairment, which was no real surprise. After the first night of no sleep at all, their lapses in concentration, missed responses, increased by over 400%. The surprise was that these impairments continued to escalate at the same ballistic rate after a second and third night of total sleep deprivation, as if they would continue to escalate in severity if more nights of sleep were lost, showing no signs of flattening out. But it was the 2 partial sleep deprivation groups that brought the most concerning message of all. After 4 hours of sleep for 6 nights, participants' performance was just as bad as those who had not slept for 24 hours straight. That is, a 400% increase in the number of microsleeps. By day 11 on this diet of 4 hours of sleep a night, participants' performance had degraded even further, matching that of someone who had pulled 2 back-to-back all-nighters, going without sleep for 48 hours. Most worrying from a societal perspective, were the individuals in the group who obtained 6 hours of sleep a night, something that may sound similar to many of you. 10 days of 6 hours of sleep a night was all it took to become as impaired in performance as going without sleep for 24 hours straight. And like the total sleep deprivation group, the accruing performance impairment in the 4-hour and 6-hour sleep groups showed no signs of leveling out. All signs suggested that if the experiment had continued, the performance deterioration would continue to build up over weeks or months. Another research study, this one led by Dr. Gregory Belenke at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, published almost identical results around the same time. They also tested 4 groups of participants, but they were given 9 hours, 7 hours, 5 hours, and 3 hours of sleep, across 7 days. You do not know how sleep-deprived you are when you are sleep-deprived. The third key finding, common to both of these studies, is the one I personally think is the most harmful of all. When participants were asked about their subjective sense of how impaired they were, they consistently underestimated their degree of performance disability. It was a miserable predictor of how bad their performance actually, objectively was. It is the equivalent of someone at a bar who has had far too many drinks, picking up his car keys and confidently telling you, "I'm fine to drive home." Similarly problematic is baseline resetting. With chronic sleep restriction over months or years, an individual will actually acclimate to their impaired performance, lower alertness, and reduced energy levels. That low-level exhaustion becomes their accepted norm, or baseline. Individuals fail to recognize how their perennial state of sleep deficiency has come to compromise their mental aptitude and physical vitality, including the slow accumulation of ill health. A link between the former and latter is rarely made in their mind. Based on epidemiological studies of average sleep time, millions of individuals unwittingly spend years of their life in a suboptimal state of psychological and physiological functioning, never maximizing their potential of mind or body due to their blind persistence in sleeping too little. 60 years of scientific research prevent me from accepting anyone who tells me that he or she can get by on just 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night just fine. Returning to Dinges's study results, you may have predicted that optimal performance would return to all the participants after a good long night of recovery sleep, similar to many people's notion of sleeping it off on the weekends to pay off their weeknight sleep debt. However, even after 3 nights of ad lib recovery sleep, performance did not return to that observed at the original baseline assessment when those same individuals had been getting a full 8 hours of sleep regularly. Nor did any group recover all the sleep hours they had lost in the days prior. As we have already learned, the brain is incapable of that. In a disturbing later study, researchers in Australia took 2 groups of healthy adults, one of whom they got drunk to the legal driving limit, 0.08% blood alcohol, the other of whom they sleep-deprived for a single night. Both groups performed the concentration test to assess attention performance, specifically the number of lapses. After being awake for 19 hours, people who were sleep-deprived were as cognitively impaired as those who were legally drunk. Said another way, if you wake up at 7 a.m. and remain awake throughout the day, then go out socializing with friends until late that evening, yet drink no alcohol whatsoever, by the time you are driving home at 2 a.m., you are as cognitively impaired in your ability to attend to the road and what is around you as a legally drunk driver. In fact, participants in the above study started their nosedive in performance after just 15 hours of being awake, 10 p.m. in the above scenario. Car crashes rank among the leading causes of death in most first world nations. In 2016, the AAA Foundation in Washington, D.C., released the results of an extensive study of over 7,000 drivers in the U.S., tracked in detail over a 2-year period. The key finding, shown in Figure 12 in the accompanying PDF, reveals just how catastrophic drowsy driving is when it comes to car crashes. Operating on less than 5 hours of sleep, your risk of a car crash increases threefold. Get behind the wheel of a car when having slept just 4 hours or less the night before, and you are 11.5 times more likely to be involved in a car accident. Note how the relationship between decreasing hours of sleep and increasing mortality risk of an accident is not linear, but instead exponentially mushrooms. Each hour of sleep lost vastly amplifies that crash likelihood, rather than incrementally nudging it up. Drunk driving and drowsy driving are deadly propositions in their own right, but what happens when someone combines them? It is a relevant question, since most individuals are driving drunk in the early morning hours rather than in the middle of the day, meaning that most drunk drivers are also sleep-deprived. We can now monitor driver error in a realistic but safe way using driving simulators. With such a virtual machine, a group of researchers examined the number of complete off-road deviations in participants placed under four different experimental conditions. 1. 8 hours of sleep. 2. 4 hours of sleep. 3. 8 hours of sleep plus alcohol to the point of being legally drunk. And 4. 4 hours of sleep plus alcohol to the point of being legally drunk. Those in the 8-hour sleep group had few, if any, off-road errors. Those in the 4-hour sleep condition, the second group, had 6 times more off-road deviations than the sober, well-rested individuals. The same degree of driving impairment was true of the third group, who had 8 hours of sleep but were legally drunk. Driving drunk or driving drowsy were both dangerous and equally dangerous. A reasonable expectation was that performance in the fourth group of participants would reflect the additive impact of these two groups, 4 hours of sleep plus the effect of alcohol, that is to say, 12 times more off-road deviations. It was far worse. This group of participants drove off the road almost 30 times more than the well-rested, sober group. The heady cocktail of sleep loss and alcohol was not additive, but instead multiplicative. They magnified each other, like two drugs whose effects are harmful by themselves, but, when taken together, interact to produce truly dire consequences. After 30 years of intensive research, we can now answer many of the questions posed earlier. The recycle rate of a human being is around 16 hours. After 16 hours of being awake, the brain begins to fail. Humans need more than 7 hours of sleep each night to maintain cognitive performance. After 10 days of just 7 hours of sleep, the brain is as dysfunctional as it would be after going without sleep for 24 hours. 3 nights of recovery sleep, that is to say more nights than a weekend, are insufficient to restore performance back to normal levels after a week of short sleeping. Finally, the human mind cannot accurately sense how sleep-deprived it is when sleep-deprived. We shall return to the ramifications of these results in the remaining chapters, but the real-life consequences of drowsy driving deserve special mention. This coming week, more than 2 million people in the U.S. will fall asleep while driving their motor vehicle. That's more than 250,000 every day, with more such events during the week than weekends for obvious reasons. More than 56 million Americans admit to struggling to stay awake at the wheel of a car each month. As a result, 1.2 million accidents are caused by sleepiness each year in the United States. Said another way, for every 30 seconds you've been listening to this book, there has been a car accident somewhere in the U.S. caused by sleepiness. It is more than probable that someone has lost their life in a fatigue-related car accident during the time you have been listening to this chapter. You may find it surprising to learn that vehicle accidents caused by drowsy driving exceed those caused by alcohol and drugs combined. Drowsy driving alone is worse than driving drunk. That may seem like a controversial or irresponsible thing to say, and I do not wish to trivialize the lamentable act of drunk driving by any means. Yet my statement is true for the following simple reason. Drunk drivers are often late in braking and late in making evasive maneuvers. But when you fall asleep or have a microsleep, you stop reacting altogether. A person who experiences a microsleep or who has fallen asleep at the wheel does not brake at all, nor do they make any attempt to avoid the accident. As a result, car crashes caused by drowsiness tend to be far more deadly than those caused by alcohol or drugs. Said crassly, when you fall asleep at the wheel of your car on a freeway, there is now a one-ton missile traveling at 65 miles per hour, and no one is in control. Drivers of cars are not the only threats. More dangerous are drowsy truckers. Approximately 80% of truck drivers in the U.S. are overweight, and 50% are clinically obese. This places truck drivers at a far, far higher risk of a disorder called sleep apnea, commonly associated with heavy snoring, which causes chronic, severe sleep deprivation. As a result, these truck drivers are 200 to 500% more likely to be involved in a traffic accident. And when a truck driver loses his or her life in a drowsy driving crash, they will, on average, take 4.5 other lives with them. In actual fact, I would like to argue that there are no accidents caused by fatigue, microsleeps, or falling asleep. None whatsoever. They are crashes. The Oxford English Dictionary defines accidents as unexpected events that happen by chance or without apparent cause. Drowsy driving deaths are neither chance nor without cause. They are predictable and the direct result of not obtaining sufficient sleep. As such, they are unnecessary and preventable. Shamefully, governments of most developed countries spend less than 1% of their budget educating the public on the dangers of drowsy driving relative to what they invest in combating drunk driving. Even well-meaning public health messages can get lost in a barrage of statistics. It often takes the tragic recounting of personal stories to make the message real. There are thousands of such events that I could describe. Let me offer just one in the hopes of saving you from the harms of driving drowsy. Union County, Florida, January 2006. A school bus transporting 9 children came to a halt at a stop sign. A Pontiac Bonneville car carrying 7 occupants pulled up behind the bus and also came to a stop. At this moment, an 18-wheel truck came barreling down the road behind both vehicles. It didn't stop. The truck struck the Pontiac, riding up over it, and, with the car concertinaed underneath, then hit the bus. All 3 vehicles traveled through a ditch and continued moving, at which point the imploded Pontiac became engulfed in flames. The school bus rotated counterclockwise and kept traveling, now on the opposite side of the road, back to front. It did so for 328 feet, until it went off the road and collided with a thick grove of trees. 3 of the 9 children in the bus were ejected through the windows upon impact. All 7 passengers in the Pontiac were killed, as was the bus driver. The truck driver and all 9 children in the bus sustained serious injuries. The trucker was a qualified and legally licensed driver. All toxicology tests performed on his blood were negative. However, it later emerged that he had been awake for 34 hours straight and had fallen asleep at the wheel. All of the Pontiac's 7 occupants who died were children or adolescents. 5 of the 7 children in the Pontiac car were from the same family. The oldest occupant was a teenager who had been legally driving the car. The youngest occupant was a baby of just 20 months old. There are many things that I hope listeners take away from this book. This is one of the most important. If you are drowsy while driving, please, please stop. It is lethal. To carry the burden of another's death on your shoulders is a terrible thing. Don't be misled by the many ineffective tactics people will tell you can battle back against drowsiness while driving. Footnote: common myths that are of no use in helping to overcome drowsiness while driving include turning up the radio, winding down the car window, blowing cold air on your face, splashing cold water on your face, talking on the phone, chewing gum, slapping yourself, pinching yourself, punching yourself, and promising yourself a reward for staying awake. Many of us think we can overcome drowsiness through sheer force of will, but sadly, this is not true. To assume otherwise can jeopardize your life, the lives of your family or friends in the car with you, and the lives of other road users. Some people only get one chance to fall asleep at the wheel before losing their life. If you notice yourself feeling drowsy while driving, or actually falling asleep at the wheel, stop for the night. If you really must keep going, and you have made that judgment in the life-threatening context it genuinely poses, Then pull off the road into a safe lay-by for a short time. Take a brief nap, 20 to 30 minutes. When you wake up, do not start driving. You will be suffering from sleep inertia, the carry-over effects of sleep into wakefulness. Wait for another 20 to 30 minutes, perhaps after having a cup of coffee if you really must, and only then start driving again. This, however, will only get you so far down the road before you need another such recharge, and the returns are diminishing. Ultimately, it is just not worth the life cost. Can naps help? In the 1980s and 90s, David Dinges, together with his astute collaborator and recent administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Dr. Mark Rosekind, conducted another series of groundbreaking studies, this time examining the upsides and downsides of napping in the face of unavoidable sleep deprivation. They coined the term power naps, or should I say, ceded to it. Much of their work was with the aviation industry, examining pilots on long-haul travel. The most dangerous time of flight is landing, which arrives at the end of a journey, when the greatest amount of sleep deprivation has often accrued. Recall how tired and sleepy you are at the end of an overnight transatlantic flight, having been on the go for more than 24 hours. Would you feel at peak performance, ready to land a Boeing 747 with 467 passengers on board, should you have the skill to do so? It is during this end phase of flight, known in the aviation industry as top of descent to landing, that 68% of all hull losses, a euphemism for a catastrophic plane crash, occur. The researchers set to work answering the following question, posed by the U.S. Federal Aviation Authority, FAA. If a pilot can only obtain a short nap opportunity, 40 to 120 minutes, within a 36-hour period, when should it occur so as to minimize cognitive fatigue and attention lapses? At the start of the first evening, in the middle of the night, or late the following morning? It first appeared to be counterintuitive, but Dinges and Rosekind made a clever, biology-based prediction. They believed that by inserting a nap at the front end of an incoming bout of sleep deprivation, you could insert a buffer, albeit temporary and partial, that would protect the brain from suffering catastrophic lapses in concentration. They were right. Pilots suffered fewer microsleeps at the end stages of the flight if the naps were taken early that prior evening, versus if those same nap periods were taken in the middle of the night or later that next morning, when the attack of sleep deprivation was already well underway. They had discovered the sleep equivalent of the medical paradigm of prevention versus treatment. The former tries to avert an issue prior to occurrence. The latter tries to remedy the issue after it has happened. And so it was with naps. Indeed, these short sleep bouts, taken early, also reduced the number of times the pilots drifted into light sleep during the critical final 90 minutes of flight. There were fewer of these sleep intrusions, measured with EEG electrodes on the head. When Dinges and Rosekind reported their findings to the FAA, they recommended that prophylactic naps, naps taken early during long-haul flights, should be instituted as policy among pilots, as many other aviation authorities around the world now permit. The FAA, while believing the findings, was not convinced by the nomenclature. They believed the term prophylactic was ripe for many a snide joke among pilots. Dinges suggested the alternative of planned napping. The FAA didn't like this either, feeling it to be too management-like. Their suggestion was power napping, which they believed was more fitting with leadership or dominance-based job positions, others being CEOs or military executives. And so the power nap was born. The problem, however, is that people, especially those in such positions, came to erroneously believe that a 20-minute power nap was all you needed to survive and function with perfect or even acceptable acumen. Brief power naps have become synonymous with the inaccurate assumption that they allow an individual to forgo sufficient sleep, night after night, especially when combined with the liberal use of caffeine. No matter what you may have heard or read in the popular media, there is no scientific evidence we have suggesting that a drug, a device, or any amount of psychological willpower can replace sleep. Power naps may momentarily increase basic concentration under conditions of sleep deprivation, as can caffeine up to a certain dose. But in the subsequent studies that Dinges and many other researchers, myself included, have performed, neither naps nor caffeine can salvage more complex functions of the brain, including learning, memory, emotional stability, complex reasoning, or decision-making. One day we may discover such a counteractive method. Currently, however, there is no drug that has the proven ability to replace those benefits that a full night of sleep infuses into the brain and body. David Dinges has extended an open invitation to anyone suggesting that they can survive on short sleep to come to his lab for a 10-day stay. He will place that individual on their proclaimed regimen of short sleep and measure their cognitive function. Dinges is rightly confident he'll show, categorically, a degradation of brain and body function. To date, no volunteers have matched up to their claim. We have, however, discovered a very rare collection of individuals who appear to be able to survive on 6 hours of sleep and show minimal impairment, a sleepless elite, as it were. Give them hours and hours of sleep opportunity in the laboratory, with no alarms or wake-up calls, and still they naturally sleep this short amount and no more. Part of the explanation appears to lie in their genetics, specifically a subvariant of a gene called BHLHE41. Scientists are now trying to understand what this gene does and how it confers resilience to such little sleep. Having learned this, I imagine that some readers now believe that they are one of these individuals. That is very, very unlikely. The gene is remarkably rare, with but a soupçon of individuals in the world estimated to carry this anomaly. To impress this fact further, I quote one of my research colleagues, Dr. Thomas Roth, at the Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, who once said, "The number of people who can survive on 5 hours of sleep or less without any impairment, expressed as a percent of the population and rounded to a whole number, is zero. There is but a fraction of 1% of the population who are truly resilient to the effects of chronic sleep restriction at all levels of brain function. It is far, far more likely that you will be struck by lightning, the lifetime odds being 1 in 12,000, than being truly capable of surviving on insufficient sleep thanks to a rare gene." Emotional irrationality. "I just snapped, and..." Those words are often part of an unfolding tragedy, as a soldier irrationally responds to a provocative civilian, a physician to an entitled patient, or a parent to a misbehaving child. All of these situations are ones in which inappropriate anger and hostility are dealt out by tired, sleep-deprived individuals. Many of us know that inadequate sleep plays havoc with our emotions. We even recognize it in others. Consider another common scenario of a parent holding a young child who is screaming or crying, and in the midst of the turmoil, turns to you and says, "Well, Stephen just didn't get enough sleep last night." Universal parental wisdom knows that bad sleep the night before leads to a bad mood and emotional reactivity the next day. While the phenomenon of emotional irrationality following sleep loss is subjectively and anecdotally common, until recently, we did not know how sleep deprivation influenced the emotional brain at a neural level, despite the professional, psychiatric, and societal ramifications. Several years ago, my team and I conducted a study using MRI brain scanning to address the question. We studied two groups of healthy young adults. One group stayed awake all night, monitored under full supervision in my laboratory, while the other group slept normally that night. During the brain scanning session the next day, participants in both groups were shown the same 100 pictures that ranged from neutral and emotional content, for example, a basket, a piece of driftwood, to emotionally negative, For example, a burning house, a venomous snake about to strike. Using this emotional gradient of pictures, we were able to compare the increase in brain response to the increasingly negative emotional triggers. Analysis of the brain scans revealed the largest effects I have measured in my research to date. A structure located in the left and right sides of the brain, called the amygdala, a key hotspot for triggering strong emotions such as anger and rage, and linked to the fight-or-flight response, showed well over a 60% amplification in emotional reactivity in the participants who were sleep-deprived. In contrast, the brain scans of those individuals who were given a full night's sleep evinced a controlled, modest degree of reactivity in the amygdala, despite viewing the very same images. It was as though, without sleep, our brain reverts to a primitive pattern of uncontrolled reactivity. We produce unmetered, inappropriate emotional reactions, and are unable to place events into a broader or considered context. This answer raised another question. Why were the emotion centers of the brain so excessively reactive without sleep? Further MRI studies using more refined analyses allowed us to identify the root cause. After a full night of sleep, the prefrontal cortex, the region of the brain that sits just above your eyeballs, is most developed in humans relative to other primates and is associated with rational, logical thought and decision-making, was strongly coupled to the amygdala, regulating this deep emotional brain center with inhibitory control. With a full night of plentiful sleep, we have a balanced mix between our emotional gas pedal, amygdala, and brake, prefrontal cortex. Without sleep, however, the strong coupling between these two brain regions is lost. We cannot rein in our atavistic impulses. Too much emotional gas pedal, amygdala, and not enough regulatory brake, prefrontal cortex. Without the rational control given to us each night by sleep, we're not on a neurological, and hence emotional, even keel. Recent studies by a research team in Japan have now replicated our findings, but they've done so by restricting participants' sleep to 5 hours for 5 nights. No matter how you take sleep from the brain, acutely across an entire night, or chronically by short sleeping for a handful of nights, the emotional brain consequences are the same. When we conducted our original experiments, I was struck by the pendulum-like swings in the mood and emotions of our participants. In a flash, sleep-deprived subjects would go from being irritable and antsy to punch-drunk giddy, only to then swing right back to a state of vicious negativity. They were traversing enormous emotional distances, from negative to neutral to positive, and all the way back again, within a remarkably short period of time. It was clear that I had missed something. I needed to conduct a sister study to the one I described before, but now explore how the sleep-deprived brain responds to increasingly positive and rewarding experiences, such as exciting images of extreme sports, or the chance of winning increasing amounts of money in fulfilling tasks. We discovered that different deep emotional centers in the brain, just above and behind the amygdala, called the striatum, associated with impulsivity and reward, and bathed by the chemical dopamine, had become hyperactive in sleep-deprived individuals in response to the rewarding, pleasurable experiences. As with the amygdala, the heightened sensitivity of these hedonic regions was linked to a loss of the rational control from the prefrontal cortex. Insufficient sleep does not, therefore, push the brain into a negative mood state and hold it there. Rather, the underslept brain swings excessively to both extremes of emotional valence, positive and negative. You may think that the former counterbalances the latter, thereby neutralizing the problem. Sadly, emotions, and their guiding of optimal decision and actions, do not work this way. Extremity is often dangerous. Depression and extreme negative mood can, for example, infuse an individual with a sense of worthlessness, together with ideas of questioning life's value. There is now clearer evidence of this concern. Studies of adolescents have identified a link between sleep disruption and suicidal thoughts, suicide attempts, and, tragically, suicide completion in the days after. One more reason for society and parents to value plentiful sleep in teens rather than chastise it, especially considering that suicide is the second leading cause of death in young adults in developed nations after car accidents. Insufficient sleep has also been linked to aggression, bullying, and behavioral problems in children across a